Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscawain. Throughout his life, backpacker, writer, and photographer Michael Lanza has grown to love and appreciate the abundant beauty of America's national parks. It's a love he shares with his mother, his wife, and many friends, a love that he wanted to pass on to his two children, Nate and Alex. After years of exploring national parks, Lanza felt that he was seeing signs of global warming threatening these national treasures. A suspicion confirmed in conversations with scientists. He decided to take his family on a year-long trip of 10 national parks and describes the adventure in his book, Before They Are Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. Michael Lanza joins us today to talk about all of those adventures. Michael, thank you so much for being on Radio Times.
Hi, Mike, and thank you very much.
Thank you. And to our listeners, we want to hear about your trips and adventures in America's national parks with or without children. Maybe you're planning a trip this summer. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. So, Michael, when did you first discover America's national parks?
Well, I grew up in Massachusetts, and I didn't first visit the national parks until I was in my 20s, actually, and started traveling around the West a bit.
And which one was your first park?
Yosemite, actually, one of the best-known parks, and Grand Teton was one of the first, and both became a couple of my favorites.
And who introduced you to this love of nature? Did that start earlier than actually going into the parks?
You know, when I was a kid, my family would take vacations at the beach, and I loved just kind of exploring around. And when I was growing up, you know, we had woods nearby, and friends and I loved to get out into the woods. But we didn't, you know, do any hiking or anything like that as a family when I was a kid. It was, you know, when I was in college and just out of college, some friends who were, you know, hikers introduced me to it, and I just fell in love with it.
But what kind of, I'm always wondering when people first start doing these kind of park explorations, some of this is very rugged terrain. It requires skill. It requires a certain athleticism. So were you prepared when you went on your first hikes, or did you take it a little easier?
No. The answer to both questions is no. We were young guys in our 20s, not experienced backpackers. And, you know, frankly, we took too much stuff. We overestimated how far we were going to hike at relatively higher elevations. And you know, just kind of adjusted our itinerary and were a bit uncomfortable and tired and hot at times, but had a wonderful time, you know. And I think that my experience was the experience a lot of people have, is that you gain knowledge and skills as you do it. And, you know, the worst thing that happens is, you'll have a hot, tiring day, or, you know, you'll get more wet and sore than you expected. But overall, the positive far outweighs the negative.
Mm-hmm. And can you recall, I think sometimes when you see these places for the first time, it must be so awe-inspiring. Is that a feeling that returns every time, or is it different the first time you venture into one of these parks?
You know, what amazes me about these places is I've never grown tired of them. I've been back to the Grand Teton National Park, for instance, for, I don't know, at least 16, 18 times over the past 20 years. And every time I see those mountains, and I'm awestruck. It's really hard to describe. Mount Rainier has always had the same impact on me, or Yosemite Valley. They really are, you know, your memory cannot preserve what you will see the next time you go back. And going back with my kids has had the added pleasure of, you know, seeing their reaction to it, and how, even as young kids, they can be awestruck by this, you know, natural majesty of these places.
Before we get to the kids, the wife, you share this love of the great outdoors with your wife as well, correct? She's an avid hiker.
Yeah, and, you know, it's certainly one of the things that brought Penny and I together years ago. was that she was and has always been an avid hiker and backpacker as well, ever since she was a kid, actually.
And when did you, how were you able to make this love of the great outdoors into your job? Did that come kind of simultaneously, or how did that develop?
No, that kind of developed over time. I spent about 10 years as a newspaper reporter and then editor in New England at various newspapers. And, you know, came to realize, and that was in my 20s into my early 30s, came to realize that I was loving the outdoors more and more and wanted to try to make a living at it. So, like a lot of freelancers, I gradually broke in. I syndicated a newspaper column and started freelancing for magazines where I could, and gradually just developed my relationship with Backpacker magazine to the point where, you know, several years ago I became one of their field editors and primary contributors to the magazine.
So when did this year-long trip start to materialize in your head?
Well, for Backpacker, I was given an assignment in April 2007, and I skied into the mountains of Glacier National Park with a guy named Dan Fagry, who was a leading federal researcher on climate change. And it was him and his team that first predicted that the glaciers of Glacier National Park, which are at least 7,000 years old, will disappear within our lifetimes. He predicted back then by around the year 2030, the last glaciers would be gone. And understand that 150 years ago, there were, over 100, well over 100 glaciers in the park. There's something like 27 left now, and many of those have shrunk to pretty small dimensions. And then I saw him again 2 years later in 2009. I was back there to hike in the park. And he told me that the most recent data then showed that warming and glacial recession had accelerated much faster than their earlier models. And he thought the glaciers would be gone by 2020. And it struck me then that my kids will be 19 and 17 years old. And the more research I did into what's taking place in various national parks, the more I realized that not only will profound changes take place within my lifetime even, but certainly by the time my kids are my age, you know, in middle age, these places will be in many respects very different. So that kind of inspired this. And also in the year 2009, my daughter, who's a couple of years younger than my son, kind of reached this turning point where she had the endurance to do, you know, more serious backpacking and hiking trips. So my wife and I decided that we would string together this series of national park adventures in 2010 into 2011.
And how old were your children?
They were 9 and 7 when we started that year of adventures. My son turned 10 during the year.
We're talking with Michael Lanza. He is Northwest editor of Backpacker magazine and runs the website The Big Outside. And his new book is Before They Are Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. We're also hoping to hear from you and about your adventures in the national parks. Our number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. So, Michael, you set out on this journey for a year to go into all these different parks. How did you figure out which park to visit at which time? I'm sure there's ideal times for certain parks, but how did you go about putting that together?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mike. Certainly these parks are at different elevations and latitudes. So they have, you know, some places are hotter. Some of them have snow into July or August. So we, I had to think about that in those terms. I had been to most of these parks before, so I had a lot of personal history in each of them and loved them for many reasons. Two of the places I had not been before, the Everglades and Glacier Bay, Alaska. So basically, based on what I knew about the parks and you know, this long list of places and trips that I maintain that I want to get to, we put together a schedule where we were doing several during the summer, but also places like Joshua Tree in the Southern California desert we would hit in November, and in January cross-country skiing Yellowstone, and February paddle, the Everglades. So it was kind of a logical seasonal progression to all the trips that really worked well.
So the book starts in the Grand Canyon, and it's a pretty dramatic opening. You and your daughter are somewhat perched on the edge of a very difficult trail that is icy. A mistake could, in this case, lead to certain death because you would plummet down. And you are about to walk your little daughter across this path. What was going through your mind?
You know, it was honestly, not to be melodramatic, but one of the most stressful times I've had with my kids in the outdoors. And we've taken them rock climbing. We've skied to backcountry yurts through blizzards. We've, you know, been on rivers with them in white water. It was just the Grand View Trail, which descends off the south rim of the Grand Canyon, descends very steeply. It's first couple thousand feet. It's basically a goat path kind of blasted out of cliffs. And so it zigzags down these cliffs. And as you say, it's you know, a fall off that. You drop hundreds of feet. And we were there during our kids' spring break, which is the end of March, which is a good time in the inner canyon because it's very summer-like and mild temperatures. But at the rims, which are, you know, south rims above 7,000 feet, it's the tail end of winter. And it had just snowed a couple days before we arrived, and the trail was very icy and snow-packed. I had these microspikes, they're called, but they're basically like these little metal teeth on a rubber apparatus that you can attach to the bottom of your boots. And I had them for my wife and I and my son's boots, but nothing small enough for my seven-year-old daughter's boots. So we got to these stretches where the trail was literally a foot wide, and we'd have to walk around these, you know, these narrow corners. And I walked each of the kids one at a time. But I realized, you know, I'm holding my daughter's hand, and she's 50 pounds. And I thought, geez, if she slips on this icy spot, I've got to hold all her weight in, you know, in my hand. So it was very stressful, but, you know, I just tried to project calm to the kids. And they'd been in plenty of situations before where they would follow instructions, and she was great. She smiled at me. She gave me a wink, you know, she said, I'm good, and we did it.
But was she terrified? I know you were, but how about her?
You know, she did not appear to be scared at all. And again, we've been in a lot of situations. I try to explain to the kids what we're doing, how we're going to do it safely, and to just, again, project this sense that I'm in control of the situation, whether I am or not. And they, you know, they've trusted that we've gotten through other situations before. And I think, you know, they draw a lot from the attitude that their parents project. Their parents are nervous. They read that there's a reason to be nervous. And if not, they're good with it.
Yeah, we're coming up on a break. That's Michael Lanza. His new book is Before They Are Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. We'll talk more with Michael after our break. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 if you want to talk about your trips and adventures in America's national parks. You're listening to Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with Continuously Controlled Damping, or CCD. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
The rate of new HIV infection in Philadelphia is five times the national average. There are more than 30,000 living with the virus in our city, and one in five don't know it. June is AIDS Education Month, and Philadelphia Fight is holding events throughout June for youth, faith leaders, medical providers, and the greater community, including National HIV Testing Day on June 27th. All events are open to the public. More about AIDS Education Month at fight.org/AEM. Philadelphia Fight supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Judges and juries are forcing private companies to pay millions of dollars to victims of their employees' cell phone-related car accidents. Also, the showdown over voter registration in Florida. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Hey everybody, Jad here. Radiolab is coming to Philadelphia with a live show. We'll be joined on stage by Dimitri Martin, the musician Tao Nguyen, and the Palabolas Dance Theater. Come check us out at the Academy of Music on June 29th. Tickets are at radiolab.org.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about America's national parks and traveling and exploring them, in this case, with the entire family. Our guest is Michael Lancia. He's an outdoors enthusiast, and his new book is Before They're Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. And Michael, before our break, you were describing a pretty dramatic hike in the Grand Canyon with your daughter crossing some icy trails. Now, when you're hiking and doing these trips with your kids, who were small at the time, you have to carry all their stuff as well, correct?
Yeah, that's right. My son, around the age of 9 and a half, said he wanted to try to carry his own backpack. And there was a bit of an adjustment at first. The first couple times he did it, it was tough for him. But still, he would carry his sleeping bag and clothes. My wife and I would split up basically all the family's gear and all our food for however many days we're out there, which generally, you know, would mean my wife carrying 35 to 40 pounds, and she's strong and an experienced backpacker, and I would end up carrying anywhere from 50 to 60 pounds.
Especially water, thinking, right? A lot of water?
Yeah. In a place like the Grand Canyon, especially because it's a desert, there are very few water sources, and in fact, on our four-day hike in there, we knew that we would not come upon any water sources for the last day, basically. So at our last creek that we reached, we had to leave it with all the water we would need for about 24 hours. So I put 13 liters of water into my pack, which is about 27 pounds just in water. And it's part of the interesting backstory of climate in the Grand Canyon is that it's getting so much hotter in a place that's already very hot and dry, in a place where it's very challenging to backpack anyway because of the amount of water you generally have to carry. On this 29-mile hike, for instance, from Grandview Point to the South Kaibab Trail, there were four potential water sources, but those are ephemeral in the sense that they'll often dry up typically by late summer or fall. They wouldn't be flowing. And then as, you know, the snow returns in winter, they'll be flowing in by spring. But, you know, with projections for the, you know, several degrees in average temperature rise in the Southwest, the temperature there is projected to rise more and faster than in most parts of the country. Many of those ephemeral water sources could be permanently dry in coming decades, which means that, you know, this 29-mile hike where, you know, this coming fall, for instance, you might only have one or two sources of water reliable, that could be the norm, the new norm in the future.
So this would be far more challenging for future hikers?
Well, to think that, you know, a family of four would need 27, 30 pounds of water for a day, to think that you had to, you know, carry 4 days worth of water, it would basically be impossible.
What about wildlife? I mean, we're talking hikers, but how would this change in the water resources affect the wildlife?
Tremendously. The Grand Canyon covers about 1.2 million acres, and there are something like 600 springs in the canyon, but they only cover about 1/100th of 1% of the canyon's area. And they're, you know, they are the environment for much of the, you know, the plant life that grows in the canyon. So, you know, scientists now are trying to figure out what this will mean for life in the Grand Canyon. But certainly, you know, it's such a dry and hot place already, and much of it is parched and arid and essentially, you know, almost lifeless except for a few hardy plants and sagebrush and grasses and whatnot. So it's not hard to kind of, you know, envision that this is not going to be good for plant and animal life in a place like that.
Yeah. Let's get a phone call in. We have Miller joining us from New Jersey. Hello, you're on Radio Times.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say how thrilled I am to hear about the book. I look forward to reading it. My family and I, in 2004, had the opportunity to take the summer off. And I took my son, 4, and my son, 8, and my wife and myself, and we drove across the country in a 1999 Volkswagen pop-top Winnebago camper.
You went all the way.
All the way. We visited 23 national parks in 66 days. And just had an amazing time. And to this day, my kids have taken from it. This morning at breakfast, my 11-year-old looked at me and said, "You know, Dad, we have 8 days left for school. We could leave on Monday and come back before school starts again," which is something I'd love to give them again. But you take those opportunities when you get them.
Yeah, and how long ago was this?
This was in 2004.
So how old are your children now?
I have a 11-year-old and a 15-year-old, and I can only say that from the results of the experience of the national parks and what my kids saw, my 15-year-old is currently working on his Eagle Project as a Boy Scout.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. That's thank you for sharing. That's a wonderful full memory.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's amazing, and what the rangers of the national parks of this country do, show, and work at with families who come through, they should be so complimented and just, I don't know, too emotional. Sorry.
Thank you so much. And Michael, was creating memories must have been part of your motivation in putting this trip together as well?
Yes, absolutely, Mike. And that was a great story that Miller shared. And I think that's, you know, that's the sort of the typical, you know, tale that people tell when they visit the parks. They're such magnificent places. You know, no one can help but be awed and inspired by them. And that includes young kids. My kids have now been to many national parks, and I've had many backpacking and kayaking and climbing and other experiences. And you know, this kind of shapes how they are as people. They have a vocabulary that I didn't have as a kid that many people don't have, I think. They know places personally. And it, you know, it informs them as people, I think, in a way that makes them more curious and smarter.
I wonder, though, how they experience the place and how different it is from adults. Like, for example, if I take my kids to the zoo, they might hone in on a puddle that they really like and spend half an hour at that puddle. You know, never mind, there's elephants and lions next to them, and they seem to not even notice that. Did you have that kind of experience with your kids at times when you were thinking, no, look at the rocks?
Yeah, all the time. I can, you know, remember them making comments like, what is it with a dolphin? Views, why is it a big deal? Yeah, kids experience a place differently, and they want to interact directly with it. So, you know, water is a wonderful thing for kids, right? If it's a lake or a stream, they want to play in it. You know, my kids have never met a stick or a rock they didn't want to pick up and do something with or throw. They're more in tune to their immediate surroundings and what they can do in it. And still at times, you know, I can remember when we, you know, first stepped up to the south rim of the Grand Canyon, and you just, you know, you go from this kind of flat plateau with some forest to the abruptly reaching the rim of this canyon that drops a mile away below your toes and just sprawls for many miles in every direction. And my son, you know, just saying, oh, my God, that's unbelievable. Mm. So, you know, they can be, you know, overwhelmed like adults too, but you're right. They want to do different things when you're there. And I think to make it enjoyable for kids, you have to understand that you need to stop at times when adults would just keep hiking because they want to get somewhere. You need to stop and let the kids, you know, do whatever playing they want to do where you are.
Let's get another phone call, and we have Roy joining us from East Falls. Hi, Roy. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Mr. Lanza, I'm so pleased to hear about your adventures.
Thank you.
I was an employee of the National Park Service for 30-plus years, and so it's great to hear this program. I want to say a couple of things. I'm so excited that you are encouraging people to go beyond those trails that are immediately adjacent to parking. It's great to hear you encourage people to really go out and explore nature. And you've been talking about safety, which is one of the utmost interests of Park Service rangers, and so I would encourage anyone visiting a national park to go to the visitor center and talk with the rangers and find out about the current conditions, because they can change day to day, hour to hour. I don't know if you've mentioned there's a wonderful website, it's nps.gov, that will give you access to information about any park that you might want to visit. And for children, I don't know if you've talked about the Junior Ranger program.
Not yet.
We had not, Roy, but that's a great point.
The Junior Ranger program is wonderful. Depending on the park, it may be a couple of days or it may be an hour or two, and it really gives a wonderful orientation to the history of the park and the need for land conservation and protecting the park. And my final comment is one of our mantras in the National Park Service is leave only footsteps, take only pictures.
Thank you so much, Roy. Those were nice comments. And Michael, did your children participate in any of these programs Roy mentioned?
Oh, yes. The Junior Ranger program is very exciting thing for kids. My kids did it in several parks. And basically, they'll get a booklet, and they, you know, have to meet certain requirements to become junior rangers, and then they ultimately get a patch or a badge or something like that. And, you know, you see kids excitedly, you know, lining up to participate in that program in a lot of parks that you visit. So I think it's a great one. It teaches kids about, you know, the natural history and the wildlife and the you know, flora of a park. So in a way that, you know, gets them excited about it, it's terrific. Roy's point about safety is such a good one because, you know, it's a wild environment that you're entering when you go out on trails or into the backcountry of any park, and we can be kind of seduced by our normal life to think that everything is safe and fine, especially when we've just minutes earlier stepped out of the, you know, the little cocoon of our car. But, you know, the tragic reality is that every year accidents happen in national parks because people don't appreciate that a river is dangerous, or, you know, you don't want to get too close to, you know, some ledge brink to take a photo. And people have to be, you know, conscious of this. So it's a good idea to stop in at a visitor center and talk to rangers. And just to employ your, you know, a little bit of common sense in these environments and look around at where you are and consider what the hazards are.
And you also had some close encounters with bears on your travels.
Yeah, I have many times in the past. We didn't actually with the kids. There was one instance in Glacier Bay National Park in Alaska where we sea kayaked for 5 days in the wilderness, and we were camping on wilderness beaches. And it was fantastic. We saw a lot of wildlife. You see sea lions, seals, otters, you know, hundreds or thousands of these animals in all in one place. We saw brown bears on the beach from the water. And brown bears are the Alaskan equivalent of grizzly bears. So they're several hundred pounds, and they're ferocious predators. So we paddled kayaks up to this one beach where we were planning to camp, and we were with a group of people and with a guide, an outfit called Alaska Mountain Guides. And as soon as we got there, we saw a number of big brown bear footprints in the sand. And, you know, sort of these little beds, like these little hollows in the sand where they had bedded down for the night. And it was clear they were there the night before. There was fresh bear scat, and their paw prints had claw marks still visible, which meant that they were pretty fresh. So it's remarkable how quickly a group of a dozen people can make a consensus decision to move on and find another campsite when you're presented with that kind of stuff. Those bears might have been just, you know, up the hillside above us somewhere, keeping an eye on us while we were on the beach talking about what to do. So you do need to, you know, consider things like that and making decisions when you're in the wilderness.
And I wanted to ask about Alaska. We do have a break coming up, but the signs of global warming must have been pretty evident on that part of your journey.
Yes, very much so. The polar regions, and especially the Arctic, are warming much faster than the rest of the world. The average temperature in Alaska has increased about 3 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 60 years, which is 3 times the average worldwide rate. And winter and spring temperatures are rising even faster. I interviewed a guy named Bruce Molnia, who is a USGS geologist, and he's been studying glaciers in Alaska for 40 years. He's a foremost authority on them. And he says that about 99% of glaciers in Alaska are retreating. 30 years ago, there were 12 glaciers in Glacier National Park that came to tidewater, which means they flow out of the mountains and go all the way to the bottom of valleys and into the ocean, right into the bay. Now there are 5 glaciers. Today there are 5 glaciers that reach tidewater. The other 7 that used to just 30 years ago have retreated back onto land. So, you know, there are dramatic transformations taking place in the Arctic, and it has widespread impacts. The Muir Glacier in Glacier Bay used to go into the sea, and Bruce Molnia told me it was his favorite place to sea kayak because those glaciers, for reasons that are not fully understood, attract a lot of wildlife. Partly we know that they, you know, they calve large icebergs into the sea, and seals will birth their pups and rear them on these icebergs until they're big enough to swim on their own strongly, because they're safe on these bergs from orcas, which patrol those waters and will eat up a baby seal. And they're safe from land predators like brown bears. So when these, you know, when these tidewater glaciers retreat onto land, there's no more bergs, so the seals are going to go elsewhere. The whales will go elsewhere. The tidewater glaciers tend to churn up a lot of nutrients from deep in the water there, which brings fish, which brings the birds that feed on fish, and so they'll all go elsewhere too. So it really changes the microenvironments of these places in a lot of ways when these glaciers retreat.
We're going to take a short break, Michael, and then we'll come back and talk some more and take some more calls. We have people waiting to talk to you who are planning trips or have taken trips. We're talking with Michael Lanza. He has written Before They Are Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. We'll hear more after a short break. You're listening to Radio Times.
Christiana Care Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, Christiana Care cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year, and the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. Christiana Care, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at christianacare.org/heartleaders.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, author of The Price of Inequality. He argues that widely unequal societies don't function efficiently, their economies aren't stable or sustainable, and even the rich will pay a steep price if economic inequality continues to worsen. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The Mann Center supports WHYY and presents the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert Wednesday, June 27th. It's Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, featuring the Philadelphia singers and soloists from the Academy of Vocal Arts. Then on Friday, June 29th, it's the Mann Summer Tradition with the orchestra, the All Tchaikovsky Spectacular with fireworks. Tickets for the Philadelphia Orchestra live in concert at the Mann are available at manncenter.org or 215-893-1999.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Michael Lanza. His new book is Before They're Gone, A Family's Year-Long Quest to Explore America's Most Endangered National Parks. Michael traveled a year with his kids who were 7 and 9 at the time, right, Michael?
That's right.
Yes, and we have Marcy on the phone who has a question for you. She's joining us from Lincoln University. Marcy, sorry, online. Four in the
Hi,
control
Marcy.
Room. Hold on 1 second. I think we went to the wrong caller for a second. Here we are. Hi, Marcy. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My family, our kids are older. They're 23, 20, and 12, but we're planning a trip out to Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Parks in July. And my husband and son are going to do it, like a six-day backpacking trip, culminating with summiting Mount Whitney. And the, you know, we have always hiked with our kids, and but mostly out east. So this is our first big trip out west. But I just wanted to say that 30 years ago, my husband did this trip by himself, except for the summit of Mount Whitney, when he was the same age as my son is now. So I just think it's a very special thing to do, to bring your kids up in a hiking mentality and appreciating nature and parks and stuff like that. And my husband is so excited. He spends every day just going through his pack and what is he going to take, and now he's you know, looking at his food, and he's just phenomenally excited. And it's just great to hear somebody talk about this and talk about taking their kids and just the value that it brings to everyone's lives.
And Michael, you described this at several points in the book. At points, you're hiking with your mother, and you're thinking about your children's future, and you're thinking about future generations and past generations. So that's a theme that must resonate with you.
Oh, it absolutely does. And thanks for sharing that story, Marcy. That's a great one. I think, you know, for Marcy's family, it'll bring things full circle in a sense for her husband, and that he'll have all these memories from 30 years ago doing this trip, but to go back there with their kids now, I think magnifies how special the experience is. I completely agree. You know, I visit places that I've been to many, many times, and in many respects see it anew because I'm seeing it now through the eyes of my kids, or, you know, my mom, who didn't do these things growing up. You know, she didn't have these opportunities when she was a kid or even a young adult. And, to take someone who's never seen a place like this before and to experience it again through them, it's like seeing it again for the first time.
And I wanted to ask you, Michael, also to describe the feeling of togetherness. A family can be together in their living room and they can be together at the pool, but I'm envisioning a deeper sense of being together when you're in one of these parks and there's truly nobody else around and it's just you for hours and hours.
And there's no other distractions.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something I write about in the book that makes these experiences so wonderful, is that there's, you know, beyond, you know, fulfilling some simple needs like preparing your meals or setting up camp or taking the tent down to pack up and start hiking for the day, there's nothing to do but interact with each other. And, you know, as I write in the book, in regular life at home, it's extremely rare, or it almost never happens, that I'll spend several hours a day talking to my wife and my kids just about whatever we feel like talking about. People ask me, you know, how do you keep your kids engaged and from being bored when you're hiking for several miles? And I think, you know, that my kids are just revel in this opportunity to have their parents' complete, focused, you know, undistracted attention for hours a day. It's fantastic for all of us, and we have interactions that we just, you know, we don't have at home or other environments, really.
Let's take another call. We have Mary Beth joining us from Douglasville. Hi, Mary Beth. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I was just wondering if Glacier National Park right now is plowed or if it's, you know, the roads are unpassable at this point, or if it would be better to wait a little bit longer to go there.
Yeah, it's probably not open yet, and you're probably talking about the Going to the Sun Road, which is the one road that crosses Glacier National Park. As Roy, I think it was the caller Roy mentioned earlier, if you go to nps.gov, it's the main site for the National Park Service, and every national park actually has an excellent website with information about its own park, and certainly a lot of information about when to go, you know, road conditions, trail conditions. You can get all your questions answered. The Going to the Sun Road is generally cleared at either end at lower elevations, you know, earlier in the season and probably now, but it crosses the Continental Divide. So much of the road is closed with, you know, 20, 30 feet of snow on it until early summer. And they'll announce at the website when they're planning to start plowing the road, which is an enormous project. They might, you know, make a mile a day or something. And they'll tell you when, you know, what date they expect it to open. Generally, in the Rockies, you're not going to see trails mostly clear of snow until sometime in July.
And thank you, Mary Beth, for that call. But I guess, Michael, whenever you plan a trip to one of these parks, you have to take into account that something might happen that you didn't, that you can't plan for, such as the weather going bad or anything along those lines, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they're big mountains, the Rockies, the Sierra in California, the Cascades, which are, you know, fairly far north, too. So I've been snowed on in July and August, had some cold rain. You'll get some very violent thunderstorms in a place like the Tetons and other big mountains. So, yeah, you need to anticipate that things will not always go according to plan.
Yeah. Let's take another call. We have Jeff joining us from Landenburg. Hi, Jeff. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Michael. Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
Hi, Jeff.
I'm an experienced backpacker. I've backpacked, you know, well over 3,000 miles and 25 national parks. And I've been backpacking with my girl since, in fact, my youngest one, the first trip that I took her on was when she was two. We went on an 11-day daddy-daughter backpacking camping trip. And one of the things that I've found to be, you know, just an absolute rule of thumb is when I'm out in the backcountry or on a backpacking trip with them, the trip needs to be about their interests. And what I mean by that is I love the macro. I love the micro, the big views. And as you said earlier, Michael, that doesn't interest my daughters as much.
Yeah.
And you know, so we have to do smaller days, look at bugs, look at trees. We plan snacks around what they want to do. And I've found that, you know, when the trip becomes more about their interests, it's much, much more successful. And they've just become really engaged and will ask me, Daddy, when can we go camping again? You know, when can we go backpacking?
Thank you so much, Jeff. Those are great points. And that seems to resonate with some of what you describe in the book as well, Michael.
Yeah, I think Jeff's absolutely right. When you make this trip about what will interest and excite your kids, that will inspire them to want to do it again. And you know, I've known parents who were really gung-ho outdoors people before they had kids, and you know, they would admit to me some years later, you know, after their kids had gotten older, that they probably pushed them too hard and, you know, turned them off to the outdoors because they were, you know, perhaps just a little too more focused on what they wanted to do than what was going to engage their kids more. I think you need to make it a positive experience for your kids if you want them to do it, to want to do it again.
Let's take another call. We have Sonia joining us from Fringetown. Hi, Sonia. You are in Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
I am a senior, and I would love to hike to the bottom of the Grand Canyon, but hiking back, I don't think I could do. So what would be, like, the best way to really visit a national park?
That's a great question.
I've been to a lot of national parks, and I love it, but I frequently come away thinking, oh, yeah, I really could have seen it if I could have backpacked there. So I was just wondering if he had any advice for myself and others as to how best to view the park as a senior.
And Michael, your mother travels with you through some of the book, and she's in her 70s, correct?
Yeah, she's 75 now, and she was 73 when we day hiked in Yosemite, did a couple of rugged hikes, and she, in fact, she's coming with my family this summer. We're going to Norway, and we're going to do an 8-day hut-to-hut trek through the mountains there, and she's a little nervous about it. 75, she exercises regularly, and she's trying to get in shape for it, but you know, it's going to be a rugged trip. Sonny's got a great question, and one of the really wonderful things about the national parks is they are set up in a way that allows people of different abilities, different ages, to experience them. Yellowstone, for instance, you know, many of its highlight features, thermal features, waterfalls and whatnot, are reached on short walks. You know, a lot of them, you don't walk more than 20 or 30 minutes. A place like the Grand Canyon, which is really one of our more wild and rugged parks, because from the rim, you're dropping down, and then you, as Sonia said, you have to climb back out. You can still do day hikes off the canyon rim there to fantastic views. You don't have to go all the way down to the Colorado River, you know, 5,000-6,000 feet down to fully experience, in many respects, the Grand Canyon and see how beautiful it is. And the South Kaibab Trail, you could walk a mile down it and turn around and have incredible views of the canyon. Same in the Bright Angel Trail, which are the two best maintained and most popular trails off the South Rim. Zion National Park in southern Utah is a fabulous canyon with a road up it. So you can take a free shuttle bus up Zion Canyon and do some short walks that, again, are to beautiful views. So,
it sounds like
do a little bit of, yeah, if you do a little bit of research on different parks, you'll realize that many of them are very accessible for people of all abilities.
So there are different options for people of different abilities. I want to take one more call just because Julie from Princeton has been hanging in patiently waiting to have her say. We only have a little bit of time left, but Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to say that I can really relate to what Michael is saying because my family, I don't know, since our kids were 3, 5, and 7, maybe even younger, we've seen a national park every year with them, and that's been our trip. And just this Christmas, they all got together. They're older now, 13, 11, and 9, and they put together a book, a hardcover book for my husband of all the pictures of all the parks that we went to, and then each one of them wrote a letter to him thanking them for just the experiences that it's given them. And I can't say enough about, like when you were saying, the time that you get with your kids. You know, when you're hiking a trail, you don't have anywhere to go, and we're changing partners. Sometimes I'm with my daughter, sometimes I'm with my husband, and we're watching two of my kids have a moment that they would never have anywhere else. And it's just an incredible opportunity, and they look forward to many more. So we've been to many, and I can't say enough about it. I agree with him completely.
Thank you so much, Julie. And Michael, since we are running out of time, I want to ask you, as you close the book is about your family, it's about your love for the outdoors, but it is also about the effects of global warming. So in summary, when you leave the book, are you optimistic? Are you concerned? All of the above? About the kind of world your kids will experience?
Yes, all of the above. I'm certainly concerned because, in many respects, the amount of carbon that we've already put into the atmosphere has dictated a level of change that's not reversible, that we simply have to adapt to. And yet, I'm optimistic because I think public attitudes are changing. There's more awareness now of what we're doing. There's more concern publicly. And I think what I try to communicate with this book is that for many of us, national parks are enormously important. We know that, you know, that Americans really value the national parks. And, you know, our children are the most important things in the world to parents. So I think that America needs to confront questions about our values and what's most important to us and what we're willing to do on behalf of, you know, preserving what we have in our national parks and preserving a livable, healthy future for our kids.
But I was thinking also with the title, Before They Are Gone, I was also the they, I was thinking of your children as well, and before they are grown up. So how important was it to you to do these things while they are small, and so you have those memories to look back on as they grow?
Yeah, really important to me personally. And, you know, we've had experiences that are irreplaceable. And I think, you know, one point I make in the book is that the time that you do these things with your kids is irreplaceable. You know, to be camped on, you know, the shore of a lake in Glacier National Park when your kids are 9 and 7, you may go back 5 or 10 years later with your kids, but they're not 9 and 7 anymore. So it's a completely different experience. And I would urge families, don't wait. You know, do these things now. Do them when you can. Do them as often as you can, because it will always be a different trip.
And just a few moments left, how do your kids talk about this big trip? How has it changed in their memory?
Oh, they you know, they remember it fondly. They're excited. They ask when we're going to do our next trip, which park we're going to next. They laugh when they recall stories about things we did. It's part of their personal history and memories.
Thank you, Michael Lanza, so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Mike, and it was a great pleasure for me.
Michael Lanza has written Before They Are Gone, a family's year-long quest to explore America's most endangered national parks. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.